Welcome back. It's always encouraging when you make a talk somewhere and there's a break, that people return. I think I want to conclude the discussion of the battle by putting it in proper perspective, and I'm going to give you a couple of numbers. You've heard one of these, but let me tell you again. 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry went into Landing Zone X-Ray, and in 2.5 days, from that Sunday to that Tuesday, they had 79 Americans killed and 121 wounded. 79 killed, and that's the movie, We Were Soldiers. That's about that battle. On that battle, they killed 834 enemy, and estimated 1,215 were killed of the North Vietnamese, the People's Army of Vietnam. That was in 2.5 days, 79 Americans killed. On Albany, in about 6 hours, we had 151 killed, 121 wounded. We killed about 403 of the North Vietnamese and wounded another 150. Those are estimates. The North Vietnamese were quick to drag their bodies away. They did not want to give us an accurate body count. They already knew that body counts were significant. And for lack of a better term, claiming victory, I can assure you, if you talk to any of us who were on Albany, we will never use the word victory. Yeah, more of them died than ours, but it never, ever have as once felt like a victory. General Westmoreland called it a victory. About the mad, if you want to get any of the survivors of those two battles angry, ask them about their Thanksgiving Day meal in 1965. I was in the Philippines in the hospital, so I didn't experience this, but they had gone back to base camp in Anquay. They had realized the significance of the battles on X-ray in Albany, and it was a very, very bitter time for them. And it was Thanksgiving Day, and so the division, 1st Cavalry Division, decided to feed them all a hot Thanksgiving lunch, dinner, at noontime, though. And they had turkey, and they had dressing, and they had potatoes, and they had butter beans and all that kind of stuff. And about the time they were all served, literally had their trays in their hands, a helicopter comes in. It's General Westmoreland, who wants to make a speech thanking them for their great victory. And it started raining at the same time. And all their food washed away while General Westmoreland congratulated the 7th Cavalry on their great victory. Ask anyone today about that Thanksgiving lunch, and you will probably hear words you should never hear as a member of a church congregation. I've got some concluding remarks, and then I'll share a few other things with you. Then we'll do the questions and answers. I know a lot of you have questions. Several of you came up to me at the break. This is one. Somebody saw me wear that in earlier. That is the cavalry hat. We when we have reunions, that's what we wear. And that goes back to Custer and the tradition there. And I can talk more about that later. But let me conclude my formal portion of the talk and leave you with these thoughts about war. And it doesn't matter, really, which war we're talking about. It's amazing when you participate in a battle. Everything about that battle is personal. But then when you take a step backwards and look at war, you can see that the veterans of World War II had the same experiences that those who served in Korea and those in Vietnam. And now we've got the Gulf War, and then we've got Iraq, and we've got Afghanistan. It's all the same. The locations change. The uniforms change. The name of the enemy may change. The war is exactly the same. It's a horrific experience. And here's some lessons that I've learned that I want to share with you. Number one, wars are fought by young people. I remember growing up, I was captivated by what we in the South call the war between the states, or the war of northern aggression. Some of you might call it the Civil War. But I was captivated by that, and I studied, and I read about generals like Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, and I thought of them as old people. And then I became a soldier myself, and now I look around and I see the young people that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And you do a great thing here when you put a flag up there for someone who has served. It's so significant that these people be remembered. We were the forgotten warriors. We came home. Vietnam became unpopular in 68, 69, 70. And we were villains. We were not anything other than that. And so just remember, wars are fought by young people. Number two, dying men call for their mothers. That night after I was wounded and I was in the little copse of trees where the 55 healthy men out of the 400 who walked into Albany that were defending the landing zone, you could hear a voice way over here, then a voice way out there, and a voice back here. You could hear, "Mama, Mama." It didn't matter if it was a 35-year-old sergeant, an 18-year-old private. It didn't matter. Dying men call for their mothers. Third lesson I want you to understand, anyone who glorifies war hasn't been in one. And I don't know if you noticed that your legislature, not yours, ours, United States legislature, defeated a bill a couple of weeks ago called the Stolen Valor Bill. They said we cannot limit people from claiming to have served in combat, and they can go out and buy medals if they want to and claim to have served. And there was a bill to put an end to that, but they, in their great wisdom in Washington, called that a limitation of freedom of speech. And so anybody can go out and buy medals and put them on and claim to have fought and so forth. If you ever go to the wall during Veterans Day, you'll see two kinds of veterans there, at least two. You'll see those who've got the long ponytails dressed in the camouflage, and they got knives on, and they got the not hats like this, but all the patches, and they are all talking about how many they killed and what they, those, they never, they were clerk typists in Saigon. The people I want you to watch are the ones who are standing back away from the panel with their arms crossed in a raincoat and maybe just a hat with no markings, no medals, no patches. Those are the guys who were there. They're different. Anyone who glorifies war has never been in one. Images of war, number four, images of war never leave a soldier's mind. If you've been in combat, it's there forever. You call it what you want to. You call it PTSD. It doesn't matter. It's always there. Some of us handle it in different ways than others. But we all have it. It's a curse we carry the rest of our lives. Number five, every living combat soldier suffers from survivor's guilt. Every living combat soldier suffers from survivor's guilt. To this day, I do not understand why Don Cornette died and I lived. I do not understand that. Now, I understand God, in his wisdom, decided. But it just doesn't. Don Cornette was going to be no telling what he would have accomplished as a mature grown man. He was one of the most outstanding gentlemen I've ever known in my life, and he died at 24. It just doesn't make sense to me, and as a survivor, I just don't understand much of the time. Sixth point I want to make is, let me give you the definition of a hero. A hero is not somebody who can shoot a basketball, hit a baseball, or catch a football. The term is misused. I am not a hero. I went to war, I got shot. That's not a hero. Heroes are people like Don Cornette, who knew when he rallied his troops that he was going down. Like Rick Rescorla. I will talk to you about Rick Rescorla in just a minute. Like Joe Marm. He's named Walter J. Marm. He's from Pennsylvania. Joe Marm was a lieutenant in 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry on landing zone X-ray the first day. He was a second lieutenant. His platoon, he was a platoon leader. His platoon got ambushed from a machine gun up a knoll, up a finger coming off of Chupong Mountain. And his men were all pinned down at the bottom of the finger, and they couldn't move either way without getting shot. His entire platoon was being hammered by a machine gun manned by three or four North Vietnamese. So Joe's a quiet guy. He's a very unassuming kind of guy. He realized that something had to be done. And at first, he started to give an order to one of his men to go up and take out the machine gun. And he thought, no, I can't do that. I'll do it. Now, that's not really good leadership skills. You're supposed to delegate. But he said, no, I'll take him out. So Joe Marm charges this enemy machine gun. It was behind an anthill, like I described a minute ago. He puts his back to the anthill, pulls a grenade, throws it over his head, over the anthill. It explodes. As soon as it explodes, he runs around with an M16 on fully automatic fire and kills four enemy, frees up his platoon. For that, he was awarded the Medal of Honor, the only Medal of Honor awarded in the battle of the eye drain. That's a hero. Hero is someone who knows he's going to die and takes an action anyway. That's the definition of a hero, in my opinion. Seventh point I want to make is Americans have something special in them that is exhibited in combat. We're not just another country. We are the United States of America. And that is special. And I've seen it displayed on the battlefield. And don't you ever, ever give it up. Don't you sell it short. Don't let anybody put us down. It is special. It is worth defending. And I've seen it on battle. I've seen men pounce on a grenade to save their buddies. I don't imagine that holds true in a lot of other countries in their combatants. This is a special nation. And I told you what General Moore said. Hate war, but love the American warrior. And this is the last point I want to make. When I was in the hospital at Clark Air Force Base, I was in a ward where some of the worst wounded were because they thought I was going to be paralyzed. And at my bed, there were six beds in the room, three on each wall. And I was on the end. I was nearest the window. Now, I would like to tell you, this would be the most romantic way to do it, that outside my window was this beautiful lagoon with these beautiful trees and beautiful flowers and sky. No, it was a power station. But that in itself may be very significant, what I'm about to tell you. I was in that bed, and we got a newspaper called Stars and Stripes. It's an Army newspaper. And in every issue during combat and during Vietnam, it would list the killed in actions. And when I was in that hospital and I got the Stars and Stripes, two issues actually, I still got them in a scrapbook, I checked off the names of the 65 men killed in the battle that I was in. When I go to Panel 3 East at the Wall and we have a ceremony there, I can tell you what he looked like, where he was from, what rank he had, what unit he was with, 65 times. When I got that newspaper sitting in the hospital bed, I started asking questions, and my questions were, wait a minute. These people went from perfectly healthy, athletic, in shape, to dead, just like that. And I began to question existence at its very core. I said, something is wrong. And I reached this conclusion. If this is what life is all about, then it's not worth living. But then I remembered what I was taught in an Episcopal church in Troy, Alabama, in Sunday school about God and about eternity. And that was the beginning of a long search that led me to Christianity, because there had to be something else. And I'm telling you, and you know this, you've heard it here from this pulpit, there has to be something else greater than this, and the price is worth paying. And that is God, and that is eternity, and that is the grace He gives us. It's a free gift. All you have to do is take it. And I learned that. It took me a long time. I later was on the English department, University of Alabama, a bunch of liberals. And they didn't help me much in that search. I've been hard-headed about it, but it took me a long time. She helped me a tremendous amount. And that's an important lesson for us to understand. Okay. Now, I want to share something with you. Joe mentioned the tape, the CD. We all, when we came out of this thing, every soldier in combat, doesn't matter how and where, every soldier has to purge. We do it different ways. Some of us turn to alcohol and drugs. You've read about them. We find other ways. And what I had to do after a long, long time was to write. And I want to share just a couple of pieces with you. I know I don't have a whole lot of time to do this, but I want to share and give you a taste for what I did in my purging. And that's what this consists of, if you want to get an idea. These are just two of the pieces. These are all authentic. They are from experiences, and it was my way of dealing with the ghosts that we all have inside of us. This first one is called A Voice from the Wall. I ran my finger across the name of my brother fallen years ago, feeling the edges of the engraving on that cold black rock. I shuddered at the loss. The tears began to well. I shook my head at my inability to proceed. The fear of the loneliness returned like a thousand times before. The burden of surviving filled me with pity as I trembled there. Suddenly a voice from the wall spoke to me with a clear, strong sound. Startled at the intrusion, I attempted to pull away, but my hand held to the name on the panel by the force behind the wall. I recognized the voice of my fallen comrade. "Soldier, what is wrong with you? Why do you stand here and wallow in your self-pity? You were no different from me. We were both soldiers, you and I. We were both good men. But the bullet found me and not you. That is the only difference. I was meant to die, you to live. There was a purpose in my dying and a purpose in your living. Yet you burden yourself with having survived. You've carried your grief and guilt for over 30 years. Those around you suffer because you have focused only on yourself and your loss. Come on, soldier, get over it." The voice was scolding and stern, speaking words that I hated to hear, but I knew it was speaking the truth. The words cut deep into my being, past my protective cover of silence, past my survivor's guilt, past my horror of the experience, past my paralyzing fear, never forgotten, and into my soul and my heart. The voice seemed to sense the defeat of my barriers and the falling of my soul, for it came again, but this time with the understanding of a consoling tone of a friend. I also know that my pain, though intense, was quick. Yet you've suffered for a long time. You have hurt for me and considered yourself lucky for having survived that horrible battle. I am not sure that I agree. Maybe I was the lucky one. My plight was short, but your agony continues. So do us both honor by finding your purpose. Learn from my death. Spend some time in remembrance of those of us who died that November. As the leaves fall from the trees and the cold winds warn of winter, spend a quiet moment thinking of us. But that memory must not consume you. Move from the past to the present, then glimpse into the future. Honor me by moving others ahead of my memory. Pay heed instead to those of the present. Be a thoughtful husband, a loving father, a good neighbor, and most of all, a vibrant patriot, one on fire with the spirit of our country. Stand tall when you hear the anthem. Feel the emotions when you salute the flag. Support your survivor brothers and our families we left behind. One more thing, soldier. One very important thing, and then I will let you go. Remember this. We did not lose. We left. The politicians lost. We paid the price, you and me. We were good soldiers. We went over there and fought our battles because our leaders called. We gave for our country because we believed in its purpose. This is all that we could do. So raise your head, soldier, and walk away proud. Take our honor and courage, proven on the battlefield long ago, into a world that desperately needs it now. There are more battles to fight. So do us proud, soldier. Do us proud. One more. This is called the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Like all Army officers, this captain was well trained. He had learned basic infantry small unit tactics. He had been prepped in battlefield strategy, especially in guerrilla warfare. He had been specifically trained in the employment of helicopters and the innovative techniques of the air mobile concept with his unit at Fort Benning, Georgia, when it had been converted to the 1st Air Cavalry Division. He had learned some of the Vietnamese language on the ship coming over and was an expert rifleman. As an Army chaplain, his training had gone much further. He knew how to conduct religious services in the field. He was an experienced marriage and divorce counselor, and he had had some grief counseling training. He was, he thought, about as well-trained as an Army chaplain could be. But he was not prepared at all, for what awaited him inside the large tent that he was about to enter. The very spacious hospital tent was capable of holding 25 to 30 tables upon which the stretchers of the wounded and dying soldiers could be placed. The tent was only a few yards from the helicopter landing pad, so the tent side flaps were down, keeping out the dust, the sand, the debris stirred up by the incoming choppers carrying their heavy loads and keeping in the darkness that concealed its horror. Although the battle had been going on for 4 days, the dead and wounded of the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, those ambushed on that second landing zone, were just now arriving. Some of the wounded, those with hand, arm, and shoulder wounds walking off the helicopters. Some with leg, hip, and foot wounds being carried by their fellow soldiers. The more seriously injured brought in on stretchers or wrapped in their own ponchos. And then there were the dead. Their bodies also encased in their ponchos, but with the heavy rubberized green rain gear pulled up over their faces to hide the distorted expressions of the final moments of agony. A few already zipped up in the ominous body bags. As the chaplain opened the flap door to the big tent, his eyes took a few seconds to adjust to the musty darkness, but his sense of smell reacted immediately to the indescribable odor of suffering and death that awaited him. Off to his right, as he entered, were a small team of doctors working on the wounded who had some hope of surviving. Their gruesome task illuminated by small lights on stands being powered by the outside generators whose hum was muffled by the large, heavy tent. Over to the left were the more seriously wounded, those the doctors gave little or no chance of surviving that living hell, being attended by medics and aides to make them as comfortable as possible, with the faint hope that some miracle might save them, but with the stark reality that their time grew shorter every minute. Down at the far end of the tent were the dead, recovered, disfigured, and jumbled from the battlefield, and now laid in orderly rows, quiet and still, and being attended by no one. The chaplain blinked and quietly gasped as his eyes adjusted to the horrible sights before him, and in his mind adjusted to the profound psychological impact of the dreadful moment. He began to move from stretcher to stretcher, wanting to help the doctors, but staying in the shadows, out of the way, so that the medical personnel could perform that gruesome task. As he stayed back, watching the fantastic scene unfold before him, the doctors operating quickly and efficiently, but in a heavy, dark atmosphere of silence, as if in reverence to the dead and the dying, he heard a quiet voice behind him, over to the left side of the tent. He heard someone call his title, "Chaplain, Chaplain." The captain turned and saw, through the dim and dusty light, an arm raised, bent, and bloody fingers up from a stretcher near the tent wall, beckoning him to come. As he approached the table, he recognized a grizzled old sergeant, a senior non-commissioned officer, a Korean War veteran, with a wife and several kids back in the States. He had been wounded twice in Korea, had received several decorations for valor, and had the reputation as one of the toughest in the battalion. He was hard, but he was fair. He had prepared his soldiers for combat. He had made boys into men, and his soldiers loved him. He lay stretched out on his poncho that was draped over one of the 6-foot by 3-foot tables. He lay on his back, his head tilted slightly in the direction of the chaplain. His jungle fatigue shirt ripped open, and his olive drab T-shirt cut away to reveal several holes in his chest, the result of small arms automatic weapons fire. A couple of rounds had torn through several vital organs, while a third bullet had pierced his lungs, causing a sucking, bubbling sound every time he breathed. The captain walked over and carefully took the beckoning hand, looked down into the face of the dying man, and said without much thought, "How are you, Sarge?" "Not so good, sir. I've been hit pretty bad. But you know what, Chaplain? I'm not hurting like I was. I'm not hurting so bad." "That's strange, isn't it? Really strange." The chaplain took a deep breath, still trying to comprehend the scene before him and trying to get his nerves under control. "What can I do for you, Sarge?" The sergeant quietly responded, "Chaplain, you know that I haven't been much of a religious man, that I haven't been to too many of your church services, and I apologize for that. And I'm afraid I took the Lord's name in vain way too many times, and I apologize for that too. But, Chaplain, I need something. I can remember when I was a little boy, growing up in Alabama, and my mama, God rest her soul, would get me up on Sunday morning, get me dressed, and take me to that little wooden white church out in the country. I remember that preacher more than once talk about a place called the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Do you know about that place from the Bible, Chaplain? Can you tell me about that place?" The captain continued to gather his thoughts. "Why do you want to know about the Valley of the Shadow of Death, Sergeant?" The sergeant took his eyes away from the chaplain, looked straight up into the darkened heights of the tent. A look of fear came over his face as he recalled the tragic events of the past 24 hours, shuddered from his head to his toes, and said with conviction, "Because I think I've just been there, Chaplain. I think I've just been there." The captain had recited the 23rd Psalm many times, but never under circumstances such as this. He took another deep breath as he struggled to overcome the emotions of the fretful moment with the pressing need to be under control and thoughtful. He saw the words in his mind's eye and began, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." The wounded soldier shuddered again, the mixture of air and blood bubbling up out of his chest as he inhaled another precious breath and looked at the chaplain's face as he recognized the familiar words. "He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul." The sergeant took a longer, deeper breath, still accompanied by the horrible sound of the chest wound, nodded in agreement and quietly replied, "He restored my soul. He restores my soul." The chaplain continued, "He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." The wounded soldier became visibly excited, reached up in pain, grabbed the captain's fatigue jacket and said loudly, "Yeah, that's it, chaplain. That's the place. I just left there, chaplain. I just left there." The chaplain, shaken to his very core, could only continue with the memorized words, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me." The sergeant had settled back down, gazing again at the top of the darkened tent, breathing slower and less deep. The bubbles of blood from the chest wound now much smaller than before, quietly muttered the words, "I will fear no evil. He restoreth my soul." The chaplain saw the peace stealing over the hurting soldier, and he moved towards the conclusion of the psalm. "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over." The chaplain glanced down, saw that the soldier's eyes were fixed upward in a non-blinking stare, saw that the bloody bubbles had ceased coming out of the holes in his chest, and saw that a very slight smile had crept over his face. As his mother took his hand and led him to that small church in the country and finished his recitation, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Thank you. Question and answer time, but I want to tell you one more thing, and we're in good shape, I understand, time-wise. We're in good shape time-wise. I mentioned a gentleman a minute ago named Rick Rascola. How many of y'all ever heard that name before? You know who Rick Rascola is? He was a lieutenant with me. We went through training at Fort Benning, and he was in Vietnam with the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. He took over my recon platoon when I went to Executive Officer of Delta Company. Rascola came in after Pat Payne. He was the 3rd recon platoon leader in Vietnam. I was first. And the reason I'm going to mention him to you, let me rephrase that. 99% of us, combat is a foreign experience. It's not something you can prepare for. You can go through all the training in the world, but when somebody's trying to kill you or you've got to kill them, it's just not something you do normally and naturally. 99% of us are not soldiers born. This guy was. Rick Rascola was born a soldier. He is from Hale, Cornwall. He's British and very British in everything he did and said. I won't even begin to tell you what he did. He was a platoon leader in B Company. B Company went in and supported 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry on Landing Zone X-Ray. Anytime I'm around some of those 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry guys, I always remind them that we came to their rescue. And they don't like that. They don't like that at all. But anyway, he was a platoon leader. And then the Tuesday night on Landing Zone X-Ray, when the North Vietnamese were getting ready to launch a major attack at 3 a.m., Rascola is up walking through the elephant grass from foxhole to foxhole, encouraging his guys, encouraging his boys, and singing British fight songs, British ballads and things too, and they remember the songs, and the nickname of their platoon was Hardcore, and that'll tell you something about Rescorla. Anyway, we finished our tours over there, and I won't take a lot of time because I want to give you time for questions and answers. But he did a lot of things after then, but he wound up working for head of security Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. They occupied floors 66 through 80 in World Trade Tower number 2. And he was head of security. Now, this guy had had those young stockbrokers going through evacuation drills after 93. Remember when the bad guys put the car or the truck down in the basement and they tried to blow up the building and there was smoke and there was some killed, and but not a big deal. Rescorla from that point in time started telling everybody they're coming back. And I've seen a video with him sitting at his desk in World Trade Tower number 2 with Trade Tower number 1 out the back window from the video. And I've heard him say on video, I've heard him say this: the terrorists are going to fly an airplane into this building loaded with bombs. Well, he was wrong. There were no bombs. There was fuel. So now, September the 11th, first plane hits Tower number 1. Everybody starts evacuating the two towers, including Tower number 2. New York Port Authority, in their great wisdom, goes on the speaker system in Tower number 2 saying, your building is okay. You may return to your desk and continue to work. There's a picture, the last picture of Rescorla. He's standing on a stairwell in Tower number 2 with a bullhorn, and basically he's saying, to get back to your desk, young stockbrokers, you got to come over me first. And they said, no way. No way. So we'll keep on evacuating the building. So the building is evacuated. Tower number 2 gets hit second, remember? And then things started happening. Which tower came down first? Number 2 did. Rescorla, like we were all taught, you never leave a battlefield without a final sweep. He'd gone back into the building 4 times. Having been outside, seen outside twice, we know of. He'd gone back into the building for the 4th time to go back up the stairs to make sure the Morgan Stanley Dean Witter people had been properly evacuated when Tower number 2 came down. Of course, his remains have never been found. Had he not done that, the body count on 9/11 would be almost double. There were 2,000 young stockbrokers working for Morgan Stanley Dean Witter on floors 66 to 80 had it not been for Rick Rescorla. That's a hero. I wanted to share that with you. All right, question and answer time. Yes, sir.
Describe the history of the hat, if you would please. And is that Sergeant Major who was a colonel, was he still living?
Sergeant Major Basil Plumley. Much of what you saw in the movie is very accurate. Now, Sam Elliott, you know, you all would want to be played by Sam Elliott, wouldn't you, guys? I mean, you'd keep Mel Gibson. Give me Sam Elliott. And so the first thing I will tell you is the real Sergeant Major Plumley is a much more subdued, a quiet kind of guy. He would not be the kind that would utter such phrases as the walking down the sidewalk and meeting the enlisted man and saying things like Sam Elliott character did in the movie. But one thing that is very true, Sergeant Major Plumley had an attitude. He was a highly decorated soldier from Korea and had jumped in every place and fought a paratrooper. His attitude was, if I'm supposed to die in combat, that's the Lord's call, not mine. So he just didn't worry about things. He didn't worry about people shooting at him. His attitude was, if a bullet's got my name on it, it'll hit me. So the scene when Joe Galloway is down on the ground and rolling around and the landing zone at X-rays being just inundated with small arms fire, and Joe gets a kick in the side, Sergeant Major Plumley said, you can't get no pictures laying down there, boy. That is true. Joe Galloway says, and Plumley just standing there. And the bullet, and it's just, you can't imagine what it's like with the bullets flying. But the real Plumley's still alive, lives in Columbus, Georgia. And when the movie came out, we were all invited to a preview before it was going to be released to the public. And we were all invited to the Post Theater there at Fort Benning. Kathy went with me. And I'll talk more about the movie in a minute, but when the movie was over, they had a reception for us. The theater was locked up. The public couldn't come in. It was just us and the survivors of the two battlefields in the Idrang. And I noticed Sergeant Major Plumley. Now keep in mind, I was a lieutenant. I was an officer. And officers supposedly outrank enlisted men and non-commissioned officers. Well, nobody outranks a sergeant major. Let me just tell you now. Sergeant, now the movie did that great. It showed Sam Elliott, it showed Plumley and the Mel Gibson character, Hal Moore, basically running the show. And that's very true. So I see Sergeant Major Plumley and his wife over by the popcorn stand. And I thought, I'm going to have a little fun. So I walked over there and I said, Sergeant Major, I didn't know you talked like that. The movie, the Sam Elliott character, he said, Lieutenant, you're going to get yourself in trouble if you keep saying that in front of my wife. So I quickly turned and walked away. He was an unbelievable soldier. He was fantastic in combat. He was the rallying point for many of the enlisted men. The Lost Platoon, Sergeant Ernie Savage was the ranking guy in the Lost Platoon. Ernie Savage also lives in Columbus, Georgia, and he gives Plumley more credit than he does Hal Moore about recovering the Lost Platoon. Plumley's quite a man, quite a man. Very old now, though. We had Joe Galloway was awarded the Doughboy Award at Fort Benning about 4 months ago. And I went over there for that ceremony, and Plumley was there, but Plumley had his children with him, and they had to help him get up and sit down. He's reaching age now. He's infirm, but he's still a sergeant major. Quite a guy. Good question, though. Next question. Yes, sir. Oh, the hat, keep in mind 7th Cavalry. This is a cavalry hat. Now, this is the fancy one. This is the dress hat. You wouldn't dare wear this in the field. In Vietnam, if you see any pictures of Vietnam, you will typically see this hat being worn by the helicopter pilots of the cavalry squadrons. They not only wear these hats, but they have these long handlebar mustaches, and they were the ones that were basically the chopper pilots flying us into and out of the battlefields. But the history of the hat goes back to Custer and the Plains Wars versus the Indians. When you were riding horses and you were out and going across Montana and Kansas and places like that all day long, you had to shield yourself from the sun and you had to shield yourself from the sand. And so the hats, the actual cavalry hats had a much broader brim and they were floppier than this. This is a dress hat that we all wear now when we put our uniforms on. But the original cavalry hats had tall brims and then the brim would go out and be floppy tall crowns and then floppy brims. And then they wore scarves because when they got into a dust storm, they would simply pull them over their faces so the dust wouldn't get in their nose and mouth. And so that's the tradition. It goes back to 7th Cavalry and Custer. Now keep in mind, we were very aware that we almost duplicated history. We, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, almost were annihilated in that battle on the banks of a river, the Idrang, and not the Little Bighorn. We've been very aware of that ever since that battle was over. We were down for the count. We were surprised. The North Vietnamese closed with us, and they were so excited. Some battle records from their writings have been made available through the Internet. And they were so sure that they had an American battalion down that cooks and majors and colonels were charging the landing zone at Albany as well. We killed more general grade officers on Albany than they ever killed on X-ray because they were coming in to finish us off. We were like the boxer who's down for the count, and the referee gets to the count of 9, and the boxer gets up off the canvas and wins the battle. That was kind of what we did. We were down for the count. They had us. And we responded. Yes, sir.
What was the delay when you called? If an aircraft was called in, were they just ready within minutes, or what was the delay before they
came? They were not in that case. I think that the A1Es, there's even been some debate whether the Air Force or Navy A1Es. They were not Army. The two A1Es that saved us on the landing zone, they were further away than Pleiku. Pleiku was our kickoff point there in the central highland, in the western province of Pleiku, where the battle took place. I think these boys came from a base over near the South China Sea. But you got to remember, Vietnam's a long, skinny country, and they wouldn't have that far to fly going from east to west. I think they came from Quy Nhon. When I went back in the country after my hospital stay, I saw a lot of A1Es on the ground at the base at Quy Nhon. I'm thinking they came from there. I'd love to meet those guys. I've never met the guys that piloted those two aircraft. They saved us. They saved us. Again, having no concept of time, from the time the battle started, now 1:15 is what Joe says in the book. Joe Galloway says in the book, so I'll accept that. And then I was hit, and then I was dragged for a ways before the A1Es came in. I'm guessing an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, something like that. Most of the dead and wounded in that battle of the Americans took place from 1:15 to 3:30, 4 o'clock. Battle was over by then, just about. We didn't know it, but it was over. It was quick. It was fast. Brutal. Yes, sir.
So did your unit rotate back stateside together?
No. We did not. We, in fact, part of the problem we had right after when I got promoted, we had a big turnover. We had a brand new S-3. That's the operations officer's captain. That's Captain Spires. That's the funeral I went to in Arlington last weekend. Had a brand new S-3. Had a brand new battalion commander, Colonel McDade. He replaced Colonel John D. White. So we had a new leader. We had a new Charlie Company commander. Don Cornett's company commander was new. So there was a lot of turnover immediately before the Battle in the Iron Triangle. That was one of the problems that we had that 1st of the 7th didn't have. They went over as basically a unit because they were converted from 11th Air Assault into 1st Cav Air Mobile. We would rotate back when our tour of duty came up individually. So we did not go back as a unit. We did not rotate back as a unit. When I left the country, I went back with Captain McIntosh. He was our S-4. And S-4 is a supply officer. And we went back, and just the two of us, all the way back to the States together. I mean, it was really funny. There's something called a short-timer's attitude when you're in combat, and you get down to the last weeks or so before you're leaving the country. You get a short-timer's attitude, which means I ain't going to die in the next 10 days. I'm getting out of here. And so you do stupid things. We were at Tonsonute Air Base at an officer's quarters waiting for the airplane that was going to come in 4 days later. We never left the officer's quarters. Now, I'm talking about a motel room with a bathroom. We stayed there for 4 days. Everybody said, y'all need to go down to see Saigon. They were rolling hand grenades down the movie theater aisles. Not this boy. Uh-uh. I'm getting back to the States. And McIntosh was right there with me. So we individual rotations.
So what happened after that? Were you still in the unit, another unit?
I had, that was the end of my 2-year ROTC tour. I had a year at Fort Benning and a year in Vietnam, except the 2 months. Well, not quite a year in Vietnam, but except the 2 months I was at Clark Air Base Hospital. I became a civilian. I put on civilian clothes. I caught a cab. I came out of Oakland Army Terminal, Oakland, California, caught a cab, went across the river, checked into the Mark Hopkins Hotel as a civilian, went out the next morning and saw an anti-war parade going on. And that hurt me beyond belief, and I started flying back to Alabama. I got bumped in New Iberia, Louisiana. And then flew into Montgomery, Alabama, and they were there to meet me. Joe at the time worked for WSFA-TV in Montgomery. Joe Hendler, and I wasn't married to Kathy, it didn't hurt at the time. And my parents met me at the little old it was at night, late at night, wasn't it?
I don't have any idea.
Okay. Thanks for remembering. But anyway, it was late at night, and they met me at the airport, and that was it. I do remember this. It was really interesting. Mom and Dad and my sister took me home, and at the time I was living in a basement bedroom on 401 Murphy Street in Troy, Alabama. And I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning and felt strange. And I looked up, and my sister had invited two of her friends over, and they were standing there at the foot of the bed looking at me. Just standing there looking. And I spoke to them, and they left. Weird. My sister is. Yes, sir.
When did, like, division or higher realize there was a tactical problem with that movement, and did they try to suppress that?
Because it was a surprise attack. I've read some of the Colonel Brown was the brigade commander. And he wanted to get on a helicopter and fly out, in essence, take over the battlefield. McDade had basically shut down the colonel. Frank Henry, who's also buried in Arlington, whose grave I visited last week, was the battalion executive officer who basically took over. And he's the one who got the Air Force involved and got the A1E Sky Raiders involved. Frank Henry was a soldier in the highest order, and he was one of the ones who saved us. I was wounded, and I was lying in the grass inside the copse of trees, and the North Vietnamese were still attacking. I'm going to get back to your question. North Vietnamese were attacking, and Frank Henry's talking to the A1E pilots, and the pilot says, throw smoke. There's smoke grenades that make big billows of smoke, for those of you that have never seen them. And he had orange smoke, and Frank says, I'm throwing orange smoke. And the pilots apparently say, where do you want the ordnance, meaning where do you want us to fire the rockets? And he said, on the smoke. Now, how far can you throw a can about this big? That's where they were told to drop the ordnance. We're basically calling in ordnance on our own locations. The combat was that close. A lot of it was hand-to-hand. But they knew almost immediately that something was wrong, and Colonel Brown wanted to come out in his helicopter, ask for permission to land, and we said, no, we don't come in here. We couldn't get you in here. We couldn't get you out. So later, when I went back, I graduated from the Citadel as an English major. So I spent my 2 months at Clark Air Force Base Hospital, went back to Vietnam to finish my tour. And they said, Jim, you're still weak. We're not going to put you back in harm's way. We want to put you in headquarters company. We want you to write the history of 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry the first year. I said, fine. I wrote the history. I sent it upstairs. It got edited. The United States Army didn't acknowledge the results of Albany for a long time. We at times, I don't like this, but it's just not my call. At times, some of my buddies who go to the reunions refer to ourselves as the Ghost Battalion. All the glory, and I don't like that word either. This is not me speaking now. These are some of my buddies. All the glory has gone to 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry because they were on X-ray. The movie was made about them. They had a Mel Gibson character leading them, Hal Moore. He was. He was quite a leader. We didn't have a Mel Gibson. And our battle was a much more tragic battle. And plus, General Moore and Joe Galloway weren't there, and they're the ones who wrote the book from which the movie was made. So some of our guys have been bitter over the years, but I think that's foolish. We were Americans. We were Americans fighting North Vietnamese. That's who it was. And so it bothers me that there is still some rivalry between 1st Battalion and 2nd Battalion of 7th Cavalry. But, yes, ma'am.
If they knew that they were on that mountain, why did they send you boys in there on the ground? Why didn't they just take the air power and take them out?
Well, that's what they did. They moved us away from the mountain so the B-52s could bomb. B-52 bombing is a much more effective way than armed Hueys, for example. And so they moved us away overland to get away from the mountain so they could bomb the mountain because we knew there were still bad guys up there. So that was the purpose of the move. Is that what, Joe Henry?
Is there a true written history of Joe's battle now?
No.
Did you see
him
there as far as the
army goes? Well, I'm through with it. When they edited it, I said, okay, so you tell me what you want.
Well, that's what I meant. Did they ever let anybody else?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yes, sir.
Am I mistaken? The second half of that book covers what happened.
Yeah, it does. The second half of the book, it does cover Albany. But again, remember, the book was written by two men who weren't there. Now, I'm not knocking them. They do a, Joe Galloway does a brilliant, brilliant job. His handling of the Auburn experience was basically interviewing us. And he gives us our due. The movie was the bigger issue. But, you know, like Randall Wallace, y'all need to know about the movie. We're running out of time. Randall Wallace wrote the screenplay and directed the movie. And that's the same Randall Wallace who did Braveheart, Mel Gibson, and the Pearl Harbor movie with Ben Affleck. All right, so that's the same guy. Randall Wallace is a good guy. He's not typical Hollywood. When Oliver Stone approached these guys about buying the rights for the movie, they didn't just tell him no, and you can figure out the rest, all right? But Randall Wallace was different. Randall Wallace was different. He wanted to give us our due, and it was really funny when the general and Joe Galloway were on the set as consultants for the movie We Were Soldiers. And Randall Wallace, when the movie was in the can but not yet released, he came to our reunion in Washington in November that year and spoke to us. He was our guest speaker, and he had some funny things to say. Great guy, I'm telling you. He said, you should see. He said, you would have paid money to see Hal Moore in Mel Gibson's face saying, you do it this way. You don't do it that way. And because Mel Gibson doesn't listen to a lot of people, but he listened to Hal Moore. But we'd get an email. We'd get emails periodically from Randall Wallace. And he would say, now, guys, y'all not going to like this, but I got to change history a little bit. I got to sell tickets. And we agree now that the movie is about 80% accurate. Now, how many of you have not seen the movie? Okay, I'm fixing to spoil the end for you, but you need to hear this. Leave the room if you don't want to hear how the movie ends, because this is where it gets changed. Randall Wallace told us when he was speaking to us at the reunion in November, he said, now, anytime you have a Mel Gibson, a Bruce Willis, a Sylvester Stallone, or somebody like that, they have in their contract something we directors call the hero clause, which means at the end, they get to be the hero. Now, if you recall the movie, up to the point, the movie ends with the Americans assaulting off the landing zone up the mountain and wiping out all the bad guys. That did not happen. That just didn't happen. We were there. And we walked overland into the ambush on Auburn. Yes, ma'am.
What happened to the fellow who lived the supply tents? Enemy supplies?
He's never been identified. He's been protected by his buddies, apparently. And I don't even know. Apparently it was an order given by a platoon leader in one of the two platoons in A Company that were at the point. But, you know, it's really funny. At the time, I remember we walked by it, and it was plumes of smoke going up. And I remember thinking, I was tired, though. I remember thinking, this isn't smart. But I guess when I was standing there as a lieutenant and feeling funny, and knew that green wall was over there, I kept thinking, this isn't right. There's something wrong here. But I'm just a lieutenant, and there are captains and majors and colonels making decisions up there at the front. So who am I? Who am I to question? But then again, part of the burden I bear is because I didn't question. There are men around me who are not dead. And that's difficult. Yes, sir.
Different direction. Considering a ton of wisdom in the two manuscripts you read to us, looking at the current culture, a certain apathy with regard to patriotism, a government responsible in good part for rewriting the rules of engagement, et cetera, et cetera.
I think so. I told you a minute ago, and I did it on purpose, about the American spirit. It is very, very alive. The fact that you asked the question proves it. And I feel most of you would agree with the question. We all have concerns. We've had concerns. I've had concerns over the years about who's calling the shots and who's running the company, the country. But the fact of the matter is there is still a very, very powerful silent majority. And when crunch time comes, we can do what needs to be done. Patriotism is very alive. This church is a perfect example of that. And I go many, many places where I see the same thing. And we're just smarter than they are. We keep our mouths shut until it's time. And then when the time comes, we'll do just fine. I believe in the patriot. I believe in the American. I believe in the soldier, the sailor, the marine. And it is a strong and powerful force. It's just right under the surface. But when the time comes, we'll be just fine. Yes, ma'am. Great question. In fact, let me speak to two groups. First, the North Vietnamese. When the General and Joe wrote the book, they went over and met with General An, who was Colonel An in the battle. And I will tell you, the North Vietnamese fighting man was a fighting machine. The Vietnamese people are very short. But these folks came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail pushing a bicycle hundreds of miles, carrying heavy, heavy loads to fight for their nation. Remember, the Vietnamese have been fighting for years. The Viet Minh fought the French in the 50s and Dien Bien Phu and places like that. So to answer your first question, I have great respect for them. They were tough. Now, let me tell you, they were mean. For example, they executed our wounded, but they had no capacity to take prisoners. Prisoners would have slowed them down. And at times, they were brutal. They did things to some of our wounded that I'm not going to share with you today that were atrocities. Were we guilty? Yeah, you've read the story of Lieutenant Callie and Mili. We're not innocent either. But I have great respect for them. They were terrific fighters. They were outnumbered. Well, we were outnumbered, but they were outmanned because we had air power and artillery. I have great respect for them. But there's another group you didn't ask me about, but I want to speak to, and that is the hippies, the Jane Fonders, the ones who did all the stuff. You want to know what I think about them? That's what I was fighting for. It's called freedom. Do I like her? No. Do I want to eat dinner with her? No. If she were in the parking lot, would I go out there and speak to her? Probably not. But that's what we were fighting for. That's what we're preserving. The question you asked me, we are a free nation because the price of freedom is not free. And I was defending her right and the hippies' right, the demonstrators' right to say and do what they were doing. More power to them. As long as we win in the end, I don't care. So, other questions? Yes, sir. I mean, back then, that situation back then, not really. I'm not big into politics, so I don't have a feel for that. Joe Galloway does a great job here. If you haven't read this book, read his prologue. And he is, to me, it's a brilliant, brilliant work. And that may be a starting place, but as far as the geopolitical, I don't have a good feel for that. I will tell you this. And this was all rumor. I'm not, and I know we've got some Texans in the room, and I apologize to you before I say this, but I'm not a Lyndon Johnson fan because he, if you read McNamara's book in retrospect, that book bothers me because there they were sitting in the White House over the sports page and a cup of coffee, and they said, well, let's just send another 5,000 over there. And these things are on the wall now. And you know, whatever the rumors that are true, was it an industrial war? Was it a war dictated by the machinery, the big businesses of the United States and all that? President Kennedy was apparently going to pull us out of there. And he was assassinated, of course, in Dallas. So, maybe the book, the McNamara book in retrospect is a good starting point. But I'm sure there's been other stuff written. But I was there, and I know what it felt like, and I've been offended by the rather flip way that the politicians in the Johnson group were managing that war, and it caught up with him. If you know his history, he was forced to resign because of decisions he had made and such. So, but I'm not a Lyndon Johnson fan. That's a good place to start.
Jim, I'd like to conclude this Q&A by asking you a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
First of all, give us some personal thoughts on General Moore. And finally, if you'd give us the history and the meaning of Gary Owen as related to the 7th Cavalry.
General Moore is 90 years old. He lives in Auburn, Alabama. Now, for those of you who know, understand the significance of Auburn and Alabama, that's not really a good place to be living. But he lives in Auburn. He is 90 years old, and he is beginning to lose his edge. He doesn't speak anymore. He's been a dynamic speaker until about 3 years ago. His beautiful wife, Julie, died about 5 years ago now, and she was his mainstay. If you've seen the movie, she was the Madeline Stowe character, the one that picked up the telegrams and delivered them by hand when the taxes were bringing them into Fort Benning. He's done all he's probably going to do. And my guess is that, in fact, the last time his son brought him to the Joe Galloway Doughboy Award thing at Fort Benning a couple of months ago, and I went over to speak to him, and we always recognize each other with Gary Owen. In fact, that's how I'll end that, as Joe asked me. But I knelt down beside him. He knows me. He did. And I knelt down beside him, and I said, "Gary Owen, sir, Jim Lawrence." And he didn't even acknowledge who I was. He's paid the price. His body's wrecked because of experiences in the military, and his mind is just not as good as it used to be. Great man, though. Great soldier. Joe asked me this yesterday, and actually Joe pulled this up for me last night. I want to share some things with you about Gary Owen. And this is very true. And just a couple of lines here. It says, "To those of us who share the 7th Cavalry legend, Gary Owen is more than just a unit designation, more than its motto, a song of historic lore, and a greeting shared amongst ourselves. For us, it has been a very special way to say many things. In combat, it was used to respond to the sound of a chambered round that preceded, 'Who goes there?' If you were outside, Bud Alley did this when Bud Alley was taking his group into another part of the battlefield over at Landing Zone Columbus after we'd been ambushed on Albany. They did a 'Who goes there?' and Bud says, 'Gary Owen, sir,' and they let him in. It worked. Someone said, 'Who goes there?' If you're nearing a perimeter, it meant friend. Now, this is the part that applies to us. At meeting and at departure from a 7th Cavalry friend, it means great to see you and stay safe. In a veteran's time, it still means all these same things, but it is intoned with the unspoken words of, 'I love you, my friend, and I do as I do my own brother.' Gary Owen is an old Irish quick step that can now be traced back to the early 1680s. In 1867, it was adopted by the 7th Cavalry Regiment as the official tune of the cavalry. Gary Owen is known to have been used by Irish regiments as a drinking song. As the story goes, one of the Irish melting pot troopers of the 7th Cavalry, under the influence of spirits, was singing the song. By chance, George Armstrong Custer heard the melody, liked the cadence, and soon began to hum the tune himself. The tune has a lively beat that accentuates the cadence of marching horses, and for that reason it was adopted as a regimental song soon after Custer arrived at Fort Riley, Kansas, to take over the command of the 7th Cavalry Regiment. It was the last song played for Custer's men as they left General Terry's column at the Powder River and rode into history. So it is our song. I'm not going to sing it to you. That would ruin a good morning. It is our official, it is the official song of the 7th Cavalry. Yes, ma'am. We have one son. When he was in high school, I suggested that he consider going to the Citadel, and she had just read Pat Conroy's book, Lords of Discipline. She said, "There's no way you're sending my son to that horrible place." That was the end of that. So, no, there is no one else.
Ladies,
any others?
Jim Lawrence.
Thank you.
Now a presentation of a special piece of music, Mark Vesser on the harmonica playing Gary Owen. I will present a closing prayer for today's services, after which we will stand and sing the first and last stanzas of the Star-Spangled Banner. You will face the colors as you do so. And then you're dismissed to the room to my right for a luncheon. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the freedom we've enjoyed today. Freedom that has been bought by the blood of so many who have gone before since Yorktown. We thank you for those who have entered the battlefields, those who from the home base have prayed for their victory, their survival, for their souls. We thank you for Jim Lawrence, who today has demonstrated the heart of the American soldier. We thank you for his recollections on Albany. We here at this church, Father, salute the American soldier. Today we have heard the American soldier speak, and he's brought to our mind's eye those things that are so important to those who claim freedom. It is our prayer that what we hear here today will give us a better understanding of what goes on in the life of those who have been put in harm's way. Presently, we have three in harm's way from this congregation: Tyler Risty, Sean Wojciechowski, Michael Modier. Our prayer is that you would encapsulate them with your wall of fire, preserve them and their cohorts, enable them to win the victory to which they've been assigned, and return them home to their families and their loved ones. And now, Father, as we dismiss, we thank you for the greatest victory of all, that of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who paid the price for our salvation on Calvary's cross. And therefore, through simple faith alone in him, not only do we have eternal life, we have a mission here as we continue forward in the hostile environment of the devil's world to do the duty of carrying his word forward and winning souls for eternity. And now we pray that you will be with us as we continue today's activities, that you would take the food that you have provided for us in grace and sanctify it to our bodies. And we lift our prayer in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who is Yahweh Sabaoth, the Lord of the armies. Kares human kai arene, plethunthae en epinosai, tu theu kai iesu tu kuriu hemon. And now may grace and prosperity be multiplied unto you by means of your knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Amen. Please rise for the singing of the national anthem.